You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. April 14th, as we're digging deeper into the spring and into the dark times. Third wave, variants, confusion. I get it. How sick of you are all that? Kind of funny, before I get to the theme of the show, we got a great show for you. I'm going to outline the themes, and then I'll tell you about lying in bed with my wife last night. I said something that she literally almost swatted me with the pillow. Even I couldn't believe I said it. And then I realized how screwed up things are. I'll tell you about that in a second. But here's the themes of the show today. Shortage or surplus. Provinces still say there's a shortage of vaccines. Governments still say there's a surplus. Ontario says, you know, we've canceled 10,000 appointments because we don't have enough vaccines. And then people say, no, you've got a million and 1.2 million in freezers. What is it? I mean, the bickering's bugging me. We're going to dig down into that. Robert Benzie's going to join us. Is there a shortage or is there a surplus? What is the screw up here on April 14th, 2021 in the third wave? Can't we sort this out? Apparently not. So we're going to dig into the shortage or the surplus because, you know, if you hate the federal government, there's a shortage. If you don't like your provincial government, there's a surplus. Like, can we just cut the partisan crap and get some answers? We're going to try to do that. Then we're going to do stiff or save. Are we stiffing the next generation with rising housing prices? Who the hell could afford to buy a first house now? I feel so bad for that generation. Massive record deficits that will come next Monday on the federal budget. Potential inflation. You know, climate change, you name it. Are we stiffing the next generation? Or as some say, no. We're rebuilding the economy with childcare and early education. We're actually saving them from all the perils that await them. And then you can weigh in. Are we going to stiff them or save them? Then we're going to do fixed or failed. In more than 20 years, Canada was part of this, fought to fix Afghanistan from the horrors of the Taliban. The Taliban are bad. Let's just say it. And we spent blood and treasure. Men and women died. And today, Joe Biden announced he's going to finally pull the U.S. out of Afghanistan. That kind of ends the 20-year war. And the Taliban are going to surge. And I'm going to bring back General Dave Fraser. He wrote a book. He was the Canadian who led the international forces in Operation Medusa. And Canadians died in that. How do you feel if you fight a war against the Taliban? It becomes the, you almost die, you lose men and women who you send into battle, and then you realize the Taliban will win. And I remember years ago speaking to General Rick Hillier when he was leading that fight, and he said to me, I was sitting in Afghanistan with a commander of the Taliban trying to figure stuff out, and the Taliban commander looked at me and said, you have the watches, we have the time. You have the watches, we have the time. In other words, you guys are sitting here with your technology and your watches. We've got the time. How long is the war going to last? 10 years? We're going to be here for 1,000. We've been here before you. We'll be here after you. We will wait you out. You have the watches. We have the time. 20 years later, the time is up. And the Taliban have waited us out. And I want to know, does Dave Fraser, retired general, what does he feel at that moment? He's going to join us. How does a warrior feel when the war you fought for is essentially lost? I'm really looking forward to that. Now, I know a lot of you are concerned about the day's news. I'm going to get to it on the confusion about the vaccine. And I'll get to that in a second. I'll tell you what, I was lying in bed with my wife last night and, you know, we finished the day and I had done a whole bunch of stuff last night. Working, my wife works and the kids were going to bed cause they're taking their driving and I settled down and I was about to read my book and she was, and we'd watch some Netflix thing or something. I don't know. And I looked at her and I said, like, you know, I'm kind of going to miss this when the pandemic's over. you know, that everyone's home and, you know, there's not that much to do. And we kind of, you know, I kind of like the slow world. The fury. My wife looked at me. She's like, are you out of your mind? I can't wait to get out of this. I can't wait till we could go out. We haven't been to a restaurant in a year. You miss this? Are you? And I kind of had this weird moment where I was like, you know what? I kind of like that, you know, you don't, there's no obligations at night. Like, you know, the go, go, go. And honestly, it was like I kind of look forward to, you know, watching a little Netflix or reading a book or playing guitar, something that just, you know, this quiet time after a busy day. Honestly, it was like divorce moment. She's like, are you nuts, buddy? Have you lost it? Are you like, is this Stockholm syndrome when the kidnapped victim starts to fall for the kidnapper? We've been kidnapped by COVID and you're falling for it. Don't like slap me around. And then I realized, oh my God, what am I saying? She's 100% right. But there was a split second where I'm like, I'm going to kind of miss this quiet. Now, saying that to your partner is like the dumbest thing you can do. And I did. It did not get me anywhere. Let's just say the snuggling wasn't right as close as usual because she's like, you've lost your mind. Just text me if you can. Does anyone kind of like, I know this is so counterintuitive because I hate this and businesses are down and people are dying. There's nothing in here. But like just this sort of weird slowness of time at night where there's just no obligation. I know I'm, you know what? What am I even doing? Nobody felt like that, but I did have a moment last night. Hannah, my producer, is literally ready to throttle me for even saying this. But there is something about the slowness, I got to admit. I feel ashamed to say it. All right, let me get to the vaccines before I literally bury my marriage here. And honey, I can't wait. We can go out to a restaurant and go out and see our friends again. I get it. I'm not becoming a homebody. I got to repeat that to myself like a mantra now. I know people are freaking out about the AstraZeneca and the blood clots and Johnson & Johnson. There's one death from a blood clot and six people had these rare blood clots with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in the United States. Six people out of 6.8 million doses. And then you probably saw that Denmark canceled the use of AstraZeneca. And then lots of people in my family have got the AstraZeneca. And they're like, is this a good? It is still good. There was a technical briefing just a minute ago, and they said it's still good. And so you know what I did? I'm trying to figure stuff out for you and for me. So what I did was when Denmark canceled, I'm like, maybe they know something we don't know about AstraZeneca. So I called the Danish ambassador to Canada. And here's what she wrote to me, okay? Here's what she wrote to me about this. And I'm getting text from listeners, by the way, and Hannah, they hate me for saying that to my wife. I know I'm wrong about that. You don't, I've already got that from my wife, please. But listen to this. This is Denmark. The decision for Denmark to cancel AstraZeneca is based on our current epidemiological situation in Denmark, which is relatively stable, the ambassador wrote to me. This is about an hour ago. The majority of the people in Denmark are at risk, have been vaccinated already, or are scheduled to be. Had the situation been different, the decision would have been different. Important. This doesn't change that we still agree with the European Medical Agency that AstraZeneca is effective and that in general, the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks. It's also still approved for use in Denmark, and it could be resumed in the Danish vaccination program if the situation changes. So the only reason I say this is Denmark has stopped it because they don't need it, and their situation is stable. Ours is not stable. The risks of dying of COVID are way, way higher than any risk of getting harmed by AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson. That's what Health Canada said today. That's what the Danish ambassador told me. I'm just trying to get you some deeper understanding about that. So there you go. Okay, I'm going to take a break. I'm getting texts from listeners about my secret, shameful kind of like of the slowdown. Some people say, I love it. I love working at home. I love the slowness, said Dave. Oh, man. Maybe I am. I just am so optimistic. My wife is going to kill me. I never see the negative. Okay, we're going to dig into the supply versus shortage myth next.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. So you know what we're going to do? Because we have so many texts pouring in about my remark to my wife last night as we lay in bed, and I kind of said, you know, I kind of going to miss this, you know? Going to miss the slowness of all this. You know, we stay at home, we eat together. I know we can't go out and everything, but I kind of like that. We, you know, there's no events. You don't have to rush around. There's no coaching. Everything's just slow, and I kind of like it. And as I said, she almost suffocated me with her pillow after that because she's so dying to get out. Now, admittedly, I get out to work in the afternoons. Her work is shut. Hannah, my producer, is going to kill me. But a lot of you have texted in saying, I kind of like it too. Dave accused me, not accused me, but he said, you know, you're an optimist. I am. And my wife always says you have no memory of bad things. But so we'll take that up at the end of the show. Are you going to miss anything about this? It's so counterintuitive because we're locked up. We live in fear. Our businesses are shut. People are dying. There's literally nothing good. And here I am, and I'm going to bring on my friend Robert Benzi, Queen's Park Bureau Chief from the Toronto Star, to bust some myths. But here I am telling my wife, there's part of this I'm going to miss. And Benz, this did not go over well in the nighttime conversation, let me tell you.
I can just imagine, Evan. But I you know what? I see where you're coming from. This is awful, and it is annoying, but there is a kind of a weird serenity to things. I mean, I know.
Like, don't say this out loud. So many people are pissed. So many people are suffering. People are dying. My wife is, she cannot wait to go to a restaurant, to see friends, to see our families. Like, there's literally so little silver lining here. And yet when I mentioned that there's something I like about this, it was kind of like, you know, it's like, you know, I do like sliding down a banister made of razors because there's like a nice tingle. It's like, no, there isn't.
Yeah, that's an image. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about this because that's one thing about this pandemic. I'm talking on the phone a lot more, Evan. I don't know about you, but I find that I'm reaching out to old friends and just for their companionship and friendship. And that's been great. And some of them are saying, have said to me, you know, one of the good things about this is I don't have to see or talk to anyone I don't like. You know, yeah. You know, I don't have to be polite to people I don't feel like being polite to. So there is something to that. Having said that, I'm with your wife. I miss restaurants. I miss seeing friends and family.
You're not with my wife.
Being able to hug elderly relatives, you know.
Right. You're not with my wife because she's
no, right. Not technically.
Right. That's good. I thought you were admitting something. That's why she's so mad. You know, she can't see you. No, but I have this whole theory, and we got to get to our called treadmill friendships. You know, people that are in your life, but it's like running on a treadmill. You're working hard and spending time, but you're going nowhere. Like the relationship never moves. It's the same crap all the time. It's light. It's nice, but you're not going. It never gets rich. It's just a tread. And I always try to get rid of my treadmill relationships. And I want to go on a journey with my friend, learn something, have fun, have a big laugh, you know, whatever. But this has cut out a lot of the treadmill.
And that's true.
I've connected to people who I really want to actually take a trip with. So I'm with you on that. But again, this is not helping my marriage. So don't encourage me. Okay.
I'm sorry, brother. I'm sorry.
It's such a nightmare. I mean, she's married to an optimist. Okay. I was talking to Robert Benzi, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Toronto Star, who is just, he's always breaking news, and he just broke news that he's with my wife, which is a bit of a shocker to me, but okay. It's the pandemic, and what happens in the pandemic stays in the pandemic. It's a disaster. But can you bust a myth here? Is there a shortage because you got 10,000 vaccination appointments canceled at two Ontario clinics? They say for a lack of supply. So is there a shortage of vaccines, or is there a surplus because there's been pushback saying, no, there's 1.2 million vaccines sitting in freezers. So surplus or shortage? Can you myth bust for us, Robert Benzi?
You know what, Evan? It's complicated because Ontario has used about 75%, actually 73% of the vaccines that it has received so far. It's dispensed about 3.4, 3.5 million doses. So it's the most in the country. And yes, there are about 1.2 million doses waiting to be dispensed. But the government, and they've been taking a lot of heat about it just in question period, you know, a few moments ago at Queen's Park, where people were saying, well, what about these vaccines that are sitting in freezers? And the government's response is it takes 1 to 3 days to get the vaccines that they have into arms. So it's not like just-in-time delivery in a factory or something like that. It is more complicated. It depends on which vaccine, because certain vaccines have to be stored at different temperatures. Pfizer and Moderna are at much colder temperatures. AstraZeneca does not have to be stored at the same temperatures. AstraZeneca, of course, is available at hundreds and hundreds of pharmacies, Shoppers Drug Marts, Rexalls, and Pharma Plus across the province, and independent pharmacies as well. So there's that. I mean, it's a complicated situation, but why we're talking about it now is that, you know, it's Scarborough, which is one of the hardest hit neighborhoods in the country when it comes to COVID-19, has had to cancel 5 days of appointments through to next Monday at the Scarborough Centennial Hospital and Centennial College because they don't have the doses. They're 10,000 short, and that's a real problem. And the government's taking heat for them at Queen's Park, and you could argue that it's on the federal government because they're the ones who are responsible for procuring vaccine, but it's also, there's a responsibility at Queen's Park as well because the provincial government is responsible for distributing what they get.
Okay, but so the federal government, I keep asking them, look, I have been as hard as on anyone, Robert Penzi, on the federal government for their shortages that were, you know, really severe in January, February. But now they've actually exceeded what they said were the expected targets. And so is it that Moderna was delayed? So Moderna gets delayed, but that now they've actually delivered it. But they're getting more doses than they first expected. So I'm just not. That's what they say. On the other side, the provinces are saying, well, they're not coming in on time. There's lots of delays. There's a jerk chains kind of system here. And you've got in Ontario, they say, for example, I'll give you this. This is what was just said today. In Ontario, this is the health minister. Ontario received a shipment of Moderna this week, March 22nd. It was only 30% of what we originally expected. The remaining 70% of our allocation was further delayed and delivered over the Easter weekend. We still haven't received 303,000 doses of AstraZeneca. So that, and then they say every dose they get, they book an appointment for. So everything's already spoken for. So they're not, quote, sitting in freezers. And yet, if they're not in people's arms, where the hell are they?
Well, they're waiting to be put into people's arms because they can't, in fairness to the provincial government, they can't have 12 hours supply and then have, 100 people or 1,000 people show up at a vaccination clinic tomorrow and they say, oh, no, we ran out last night. So there is some element of planning that has to go into this. Could they be getting it out faster? Arguably, I guess they could. Maybe it shouldn't take 3 days. Maybe it should be 2 days. Maybe it should be 1 day. I don't know. But it's the problem is what they don't want to do is what's happened in Scarborough and having to cancel appointments, especially in hotspot areas. That's politically problematic for the government. And they're wearing it today, Evan, at Queen's Park. It was not a pleasant scene. I don't think I've seen Christine Elliott, the health minister, as upset as she was today, when the New Democrats, in particular from Scarborough, were really, really hitting the government hard, saying why are certain areas being neglected more than other areas?
And why look, was
this
she
was
so
always
going
to be messy? Well, I think she just felt that there's. I mean, she was insisting because the NDP is. I actually think this is a bit of a canard because the NDP is making an issue that hotspots are being declared in Tory ridings, in some Tory ridings in Ottawa and in Toronto versus New Democratic ridings or Liberal ridings. I think this is a canard for a couple of reasons. First of all, we know that the independent science table is the ones that recommended the hotspot area codes, the 100 and so hotspot area codes across the province. And I'm not sure, I don't pretend to be an expert on politics, Evan, but I'm not sure that any politician would want their own riding to be declared a COVID hotspot, because that would speak to a failure on a lot of other levels, too.
Interesting. All right. So is there a shortage or is there a surplus? There may be both. What a classic Canadian conundrum. God, this is good. All right, Benz. Well, I guess I'll just go back and try to sift through the reality of this. That's Robert Benzie, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, and also Marital Council. Marital Council. Do not tell your wife, Benz. Don't tell your wife you like this. Trust me, it didn't work well for
me. I won't.
Thanks, buddy.
See you, brother.
All right, coming up, I want to hear from you. Are we stiffing the next generation or are we saving the next generation? Do you think massive program spending like national child care will help save the next generation? Do you think a green infrastructure will help, or are we stiffing them with record housing prices and massive deficits? Stiffing or saving? 71010. Call me next.
sorting through the changes. Here's Evan Solomon.
Hey, welcome back to the program. I've asked you if you think we're stiffing or saving the next generation. I want you to call in or text me. Call me at 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Why am I asking if we're stiffing or saving the next generation? I'll tell you why. Because on Monday, the federal government is going to release a budget, pandemic budget, first one we've had in 2 years. They've already promised to spend an extra $70 to $100 billion in stimulus. We are $380 billion in debt deficit already. The debt's much bigger. It's a trillion. But now the United States is doing it. They've spent, because Joe Biden says we've got to have a save the next generation, you know, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, New Deal, reinvest in infrastructure that's been crumbling and change it all up. And now, remember, the United States has packages that they're investing of $2 trillion. You have to understand, those numbers we shouldn't throw around. If you took the entire Canadian economy, everything that we're worth, this isn't just everything, our gross domestic product, everything, it's $1 trillion. That's everything we've got. That's our entire economy. They're actually spending on stimulus twice that in the United States. And when they spend that kind of money, it's going to spill over here. And every economist I've spoken to, that's already going to grow our economy by one full point. That their spending helps us. So we're getting, you know, the rising tide in the United States lifts our boat. And we know that the Liberal government overshot the support, so people received more than they lost in the pandemic. There's so much support. In fact, the Liberal government admits this. They're okay. They said, they call it preloaded stimulus. That's their term for it. Okay? And then last week, we found out that the job growth was triple what was forecasted, 300,000 new jobs last quarter. And get this, unemployment fell to 7.5%, still high, but significantly better. The economy's bounced back. According to Bloomberg, 90% of the jobs lost in the pandemic have been recovered. Confidence is up near the roof. Do we need to keep spending? Well, some say yes. This has exposed the faults in our system. We need child care. That's going to help women. We need national child care, or we need universal basic income, or we need a green infrastructure bill. We need to invest in all those things. And some say, look at the other side. If you're a first-time home buyer, you're getting stiffed. Who can afford a home right now? Interest rates are so low. Housing prices are through the roof. Many people are worried about the inflation genie running out of the bottle, right? People are going to spend with exuberance. There's wages have not even remotely come close to housing. So you got a generation that's going to face climate change, lower wages. They'll never be able to buy a house. So is this generation saved or generation stiffed? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Steve writes me, we're screwing the next generation with record deficits and debt. We'll have to pay for our reckless spending. I fear for what my young kids have to deal with. That's a big one. Let me get Mike in Toronto. Mike, what's up?
Yeah, we're definitely screwing the next generation in terms of fiscally and with regards to debt. Regardless of what you spend it on, if you're paying it with tomorrow's dollars, you're basically saying, I want to live for today at somebody else's expense tomorrow. And the conservatives who are terrible at messaging should go with this messaging. And that is to all the people who are in favor of doing things about climate change today, we should do the same about debt today, because both situations are immoral. And all you're doing is saying, I prefer to live today or at somebody else's expense.
I want to ask you a question about that. And I get, you know, people always say, you know, governments should be careful about debt deficits and debt because they don't balance their books like every household. But remember, taking out debt is probably the best investment. I don't know if you're a homeowner or not, or if you have a mortgage. I have a mortgage on my home. It has proven to be probably the best thing I ever did because yes, I'm borrowing, yes, I'm paying, but it was a good investment. If I could, and I have now, we're in a generation that happens to have very low interest rates, probably too low. And my parents were like 15, 16%. But sometimes you need to borrow money in order to invest in things to grow. So like, I'm just wondering, is governments have very low interest rates. Should they be investing for job multiplier things like, I don't know, roads and infrastructure? Is that a bad investment in your mind?
It's a better investment. But again, if you're paying for it with tomorrow's dollars on top of already record debt and deficits, I would argue that it's immoral. That's like basically trying to fix your house when you're basically just about to go bankrupt. You know, and what we need to do is personalize debt. We don't do a good job of that. With what the debt we have in Ontario alone, the deficit payments we pay every year, we could solve, we could give every single autistic kid in Ontario every level of support they could ever dream of. That's the cost of deficits, and we don't personalize it like we should and realize that there's a real cost to this.
All right, Mike, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Mike's got kids. I've got kids. Yeah, debt's a really interesting thing. In deficit, you got to borrow. You know, in our lives, we borrow. For example, you take out a mortgage. If you couldn't take out a mortgage, you'd never be able to buy a house. So you could never get in. So borrowing is not always a bad thing. But the bank says, be careful. You can't borrow too much or you'll lose your house. Or if interest rates go up, you lose your house. You have to have checks and balances so your borrowing doesn't go out of control. Otherwise, it's a drug. And that's the question. Is there a federal drug that they're borrowing endlessly? Aaron, you're on the phone. What's up?
Hey there, how's it going?
It's good, welcome. What's your take, stiffing or saving?
I definitely think we're stiffing. Like, I'm a 25-year-old guy. I'm trying to get married right now with my fiancé, jumping the gun there.
Yeah,
currently, we're trying to, you know, buy a house right now. We're doing our pre-approval process, and you know what? Based off how much we can actually save and put towards it, like, it's becoming so problematic for us. We don't even think we have a standing chance to even purchase a house based off, you know, things selling $100,000 over the asking price. And frankly, the only way I was able to get the money for a down payment, which, you know, it's a decent amount, was I had to invest in a very scarce asset.
Okay. What did you invest in?
It was Bitcoin. I put, like, all my money into Bitcoin with a dream last year, and I'm up quite a bit, and that's the only way I'm able to pay for something now. Wow. Without it, I would be
That's screwed. Risky, and that's super risky. I would just say that you're 25. For someone like you, a first-time homeowner, homebuyer, thanks for the call, by the way. This is really scary. Now, you probably have lower interest rates than any generation in history to buy a house, but the salary and wage differential between a first-time price and the job you've got means you're just, yeah, you're incentivized to borrow. How the hell are you going to pay it back? He's not making the money. The housing prices have gone insane. Are we stiffing or are we screwing the next generation or saving them, rather? Real quick, Marcus in Vancouver, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Awesome. You're 23 years old, right? So are you getting stiffed or are you getting saved?
I think we're totally getting stiffed. You know, I just came out of a trade program in Vancouver, and everybody's pretty cynical. I don't think many of us have any faith. Like, I wanted to move back to Montreal, but I'm looking down the barrel of the housing prices, you know, exploding out there already. And yeah, I can't help get cynical.
So just stay with me. I got about a minute here, but it's interesting. Marcus is 23. He's doing all the right things, got a trade, got a skill, can't buy a house, can't get into the market. And the federal budget's going to be like, oh, we're going to save you because we're going to make sure of climate change. We're going to make sure that we've got national child care if you ever start a family. Is that what you need right now, Marcus?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, like, it almost feels like I'm waiting for a crash. So as much as we could spend, we might as well spend if I feel as if there's a crash coming inevitably, at least in the next, you know, 20, 30 years of my life.
Marcus, listen, man, keep working. You're doing all the right things. And we gotta talk about this question more. Are we stiffing people like Marcus or are we saving them? That's what this budget's about. We're going to spend more money than we've ever spent since the Second World War. Stiffing or saving? Great calls. When we come back, I'm going to talk about your freedom to move. This is really interesting.
Making sense of the latest news. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm listening to you. And when I asked the question in the last segment, are we stiffing the next generation with high deficits, housing prices that are through the roof, possible inflation because of it? Look, gas is up. Food prices are up. Or are we stiffing the next generation to save today? Or are we, as some say, no, we're doing the opposite. We are investing in the future to save the next generation from the same crap we've had to deal with. They are going to have a national child care in the budget on Monday. That's something that's going to help save, not stiff. We're going to deal with climate change. That is going to save, not stiff. Can't put it off. There may be universal pharmacare to save, not stiff. These are investments in infrastructure, the way you invest in a home. So some are arguing you're saving the next generation. We're saving the future, that your kids will be better off and we're building a better society. You know, you heard Build Back Better. Some are saying that is a myth. You're screwing them over. They can't get into the housing market. The jobs are disappearing. People like we just heard from Marcus in Vancouver, who's 23, who's a trade, who just feels cynical about the future. And I'm asking you this because we have a huge budget coming. And I did not expect this is going to explode like it has. My text board has exploded at 71010. The callers at 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010 are exploding. A lot of you are the young callers. Love having you on the show. Maybe we don't talk about these issues enough. People are like, hey, you know what I'd like to see in the budget? Something for me. Now, you've got some parties are saying we should forgive student debt. NDP's talking about that. That's going to cost. So some say that's saving me, and some say that's just contributing to the deficit. That's just a save for today, screw for tomorrow. Saving or stiffing the next generation. Maybe this is the key thing. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Let me read some of the text, because I'm telling you, the listeners are Evan, did our parents stiff us spending so much money during the Second World War? The question answers itself. Every generation is called upon to work on behalf of the next. Evan, every generation says we're screwing the next generation. Evan, Trudeau is great at borrowing, but not at paying back. Next generation will pay for his spending. Kids are screwed. My kids both own homes because I taught them financial responsibility. The boy is 26, daughter's 35. They own their own homes. Told them they'd never want to be at the mercy of a landlord. Well, okay. I mean, your kids, I don't know who you're texting. That's great. They own a home in their 20s. Woo, good for you. I didn't. Investing is the liberal word for spending. Well, I don't know what that means. Like, let's be candid. Conservatives invest in things too. It's not like conservatives don't spend. It's a question of how much and what do you spend on. This is really important. When governments spend, they could spend on things that are job multipliers. When you borrow at low interest, governments can borrow very differently than households. So that comparison's weak. When a government is borrowing to build a bridge, that can change, that can have an economic job multiplier that is massive. Build roads. There are certain job training. There are things that have proven job multiplier effects. You want to invest in those things. Sending checks to people can be really helpful today. It is not a proven job multiplier. Evan, how useful is a house if we have 150,000 plus 150-year-old infrastructure in a collapsed environment? People are incapable of imagining what human extinction looks like and think a retirement fund will somehow save them, says G from Toronto. Evan, we're stiffing them. The boomers are the most entitled generation in history, accumulating massive government debt to pay for programs at the expense of the future. There is a focus on saving the environment for future generations, but who is going to save the economy, says Sean. Man. I didn't realize this is so hot. Let's take a call. Gordon, what's up? Stiffing or saving?
Sipping the next generation, my children and my grandchildren, the way I see things are going. Like, if it's great, even when these kids can even afford to get into a house, but when they can't even afford to put the food on the table or pay the bills, like the hydro and the gas, they don't even know what all those prices are going up, up, up. And I don't know. The Liberals have a problem. They don't see a balanced budget, and they never have. They've been in power now 7 years, and I think Harper handed them $1 billion, and he went through in the biggest housing crisis of all. And that was nothing compared to what's going on now.
So let me ask you, because I've spoken to Aaron O'Toole just real quick. I've asked him, because he says, you know, I'm worried about the deficit, and he's made this promise. He'll pay it back in 10 years. Imagine 10 years. Like, political promises that over 10 years mean nothing to me. I don't care who's making them. But I asked him, well, if you're so concerned about the deficit, what programs would you have cut during this last year that has run up the deficit to $380 billion? And he said, I've supported these programs. I just would have done them smarter. I don't know what that means, but he won't tell me what he would have not done differently to cut. What would a I'm legitimately asking, what would a conservative have done differently? Would we not have these deficits? Or, now this is real, or now for this upcoming budget, would they not spend another 70 to 100 billion, which I think the Liberals have never justified?
Well, I'm a card-carrying conservative, and I believe what he said was maybe shave 10% off of what maybe. This is a pandemic. No one's ever gone through it. Of course money had to be spent. But what about all the debts that we were incurring before a pandemic? There was never no balanced budget. It was always spend, I forget what he was spending every year, $80, $60 billion.
And then just for the record, it was about the deficit was $18 billion about there before.
Okay, so yeah, and he was, Justin was spending every year. There was never no balance back to the budget, like all through it, and there still isn't. And like you said, World War II, the biggest spend ever. Like, when the next government that comes in is going to have to slash, cut, do something. And you know what? They're going to last 4 years, be voted out, and they're going to vote in another tax spending, borrowing government again. It's an endless cycle. Thanks for taking my call.
I appreciate it. Let me take Steve on this. Just one thing on that. Sometime investments have, like if you look, just look at the Great Depression. When FDR invested in the New Deal there, that led to some of the greatest growth in the U.S. and, frankly, the Canadian economic history. There are examples of both. I got maybe 45 seconds for you, Steve, but you've been waiting a long time. What's up?
I think this generation who supports the Liberals and they seem to support these socialist policies, they're going to have to pay for it. I mean, they think everything's going to come the way Justin is promising it, but there's a price to be paid for all these policies, and this next generation is actually supporting the Liberals more so than the older generation was, and I don't think they understand that it comes with a price tag. I came from a socialist country. I can tell you what these policies end up manifesting into, but younger people don't seem to even want to hear it. So if this is what they want, they're going to pay the price for it.
Well, everyone's going to pay. Steve, I appreciate that. Here's what I say. It's not the pandemic that I begrudge, because people, you know, and it's do we need another $100 billion in stimulus right now over the next 3 years? The economy's already bouncing back. That, to me, is a very dangerous proposition. Okay, I got to take a break. Wow, stiffed or saved. When we come back, new travel restrictions between provinces. Wait a second. Don't you and I have a right to go anywhere we want in this country? I'm going to break that myth down in a minute. Apparently not.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. So we've all heard about the famed Atlantic bubble, right? You can't go into Atlantic Canada because they've done so much better than the rest of the world, let alone the rest of the country, in handling COVID. And they locked their borders down. And even within the bubble, sometimes they limited transit between their own four provinces there. But, you know, if you go there, you got to drive there. You've got to quarantine for 2 weeks. And there's been a lot of restrictions on travel. And then today, you just minutes ago, you've got Doug Ford, the premier of Ontario, saying, I don't want people to fly in and out of Ontario amidst the worsening third wave. That's what he's saying. So I don't know. And then you've got Quebec saying, well, we're looking at restrictions between Quebec and Ontario. Like, I live in Ottawa. We go to Quebec like almost every day. My wife works in Quebec because they don't want the virus to be spreading. And British Columbia Premier John Horgan says they're looking into local travel restrictions. Listen to what he said yesterday.
We haven't taken travel restrictions off the board, quite frankly. It's about how practical are they and how can we enforce.
Okay, well, and he said he's even talking about this with the neighboring Premier Jason Kenney in Alberta. Listen to
but
this.
But I did have a phone call, a bilateral discussion with Premier Kenney yesterday on a range of issues. Among those were the concerns we both share mutually about people that come back and forth between Alberta and British Columbia, whether it be on essential travel or non-essential travel, and the consequences that's having on case counts in our respective jurisdictions. So we have not taken anything off the table.
Nothing is off the table. And again, Montreal's public health director said she wants to see border controls in Ontario and Quebec. Okay, I get it. We're in a pandemic. But I don't know if, is it just me or is there some silly little thing called Section 6 of the Constitution that protects your mobility rights? That everybody in Canada has the right to move around Canada. And now there are stipulations. There's been a lot of Supreme Court cases on this. But isn't Section 6, as I understand it, that if you're a Canadian citizen, you can move anywhere you want. And it is a big, big deal to start restraining people's mobility from moving from province to province. Is it even constitutional? So, you know, a premier said, oh, nothing's off the table. Well, hold on. My freedom's on the table. I want to bring in Kara Zwiebel, the Director of Fundamental Freedoms at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Kara, great to have you on the program. Can you please sort of help us, our listeners across the country, understand what our rights are constitutionally, our mobility rights, versus the premiers, who I understand they are legitimately trying to protect people from COVID-19, but I don't think it's a small thing to be able to tell people, oh, you can't cross the border into Quebec because you're in Ontario. I'm a Canadian. When did that happen?
Yeah, I agree. It's not a small thing. And I think so under the charter, we Canadians have the right to enter, remain in, and to leave Canada. And both citizens and permanent residents have that right, have the right to move to and, reside in any province and to earn a livelihood in any province. Now, there are, different interpretations that might be taken, and some provinces have taken the position that means that, visiting a province is not covered by the Constitution. So they've sort of said, well, if you want to move here during the pandemic, that's fine. If you get a job here, that's fine. But otherwise, we can keep you out. I don't think that's a fair or correct interpretation of the Constitution, but some provinces have taken that position. The real question is, it has to do with, reasonable limits on our rights, because all charter rights can be limited to a certain extent by laws. And the question is, are these restrictions reasonable and demonstrably justified? And again, I'd have to say in most cases, when we're talking about the restrictions that have been put in place or are being contemplated during the pandemic, the answer is no. There are certainly, I understand that provinces want to avoid having people sort of, visit and bring the virus, but there are other things that can be done to try and mitigate the risk, short of saying you just can't come in. And I mean, we've been hearing at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association from individuals who are affected by these things, and they have real, real personal serious consequences for them in terms of being able to be with family, people who own property in other provinces. And I think sort of with the pandemic, we've seen throughout that we're kind of always being told this is just a temporary measure, right? We just need to get this under control. But I mean, we're entering our second summer here. And, if I was fortunate enough to own property in another part of the country, I'd be pretty annoyed if I was told I wasn't allowed to visit it. I'm paying for it. I pay taxes on it. I'm prepared to quarantine or to be tested. Maybe I've even been vaccinated. You know, provinces in many cases are not making any exceptions here.
Yeah, and I'm speaking to Kara Zwiebel, Director of Fundamental Freedoms for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. There are people that may have a second home in another province, certainly mm-hmm. very common on the Ottawa-Quebec border, in the BC-Alberta border, in the Manitoba-Ontario border. There's lots of people that are crossing the borders all the time. They have families living there. And I understand that there's going to be restrictions. But this idea that we can just suspend mobility rights and that your charter is subject, like that interpretation, just for the record, the idea that, you know, you can move here, but you can't travel here is just like, that is such a narrow and self-serving interpretation of the charter. And I can't imagine it's not going to get a charter challenge on that. But I understand the reasonable limits clause, but I'm with you. We got to be careful what is a reasonable limit on this. If someone says, look, I've had the vaccine, I'm in the age group, I've done everything right, I'd like to go here and travel, and they get a ticket for going from Ontario to Quebec or BC to Alberta, that to me seems like a charter violation. Like, I'm not someone who is pushing back against the restraining order, but I do think we shouldn't just accept these things holus bolus without really understanding our fundamental rights and freedoms.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I think that there's been a real, I think at the very beginning of the pandemic, we were a little more understanding that provinces were doing things that were a bit extreme because we didn't really know what we were dealing with. And, you know, we didn't have testing capacity. There was all sorts of issues that needed to be addressed. At this stage, you know, more than a year into the pandemic, for a province to say there's nothing that someone can do to assure us that they're safe in coming into the province, I think it's just not justified. So we wrote recently to the province of New Brunswick. I think they probably at this point have the most restrictive measures. And basically you have to be a resident or in sort of an exceptional employment category to enter that province. And we've said, what's the basis for this? Is there, you know, someone can take a test, they can isolate for a period of time. We've spoken to people, and I wrote about this when I sent a letter to the New Brunswick government. An individual whose elderly father is in New Brunswick. She hasn't seen him in almost 2 years. She's his power of attorney. He is in failing health. She needs to go and see how he's doing and make decisions about his mm-hmm. care. And that's not the sort of thing you can do on a Zoom call. She's prepared to be tested and to isolate. She's had one dose of her vaccine already. For the province to take the position that it's just too big a risk to allow her in is I think, you know, preposterous. And so we've been pushing back against these things. But, in many cases, these are popular measures, right? If you're in a province that has a low count, you know, you want to keep people out.
You want to keep, and if you're in a populated province that's got a high count, and I got to leave it here, Kara Zwiebel from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, the truth is, it's terrifying right now. ICUs are getting overwhelmed. I see why premiers are doing this. I just think it's really important that we do this with our eyes wide open. You should know your rights. We should accept stuff. This is a deadly situation going on. But this is also, these are consequential limits on freedoms that we should understand. I'm going to take, speaking of freedom, what's it like to fight in a war and to realize the war you sent people to die for is now lost? We find out next.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
On September 11th, we all remember that date. I remember it well. I was reporting in Toronto. I got a call from my producer and said two planes have hit the Twin Towers. You're going to New York to cover it. I got in a van with a bunch of people, John Turner, Peter Wall, a bunch of other journalists, camera people, and producers. We drove 8 hours straight, 9 hours. We got to New York City that night. We were in Times Square. It was empty. It was tough to get over the border, and we spent a long time there reporting on 9/11 afterwards. Shortly thereafter, the United States invaded Afghanistan because the Taliban had obviously been giving shelter to Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, who was behind the attack. Canadians then got very deeply involved, not with the Iraq War, which was smart, but with the Afghanistan War. Well, in about 2 hours, in 1 hour, President Biden is going to announce that the U.S. is going to finally pull out of Afghanistan after more than 20 years there. The war will end for the United States on September 11th, 2021. They are out. And what is widely expected is that the Taliban will resurge as they have and take on the Afghan authorities. And I was wondering to myself, so many veterans who went over to fight risked their lives for you and I. We lost Canadian men and women, blood and treasure, as they say in the military. And no one knows this more than Dave Fraser, who is a retired major general here in Canada, decorated military officer, the first general to command American troops in combat since the Second World War. He was the brigadier general in charge of Operation Medusa, which took place in Afghanistan from September 1st to 17th, 2006, part of the NATO coalition effort. He wrote a book about that battle, The Battle to Save Afghanistan. In that battle, Dave Fraser sent men and women into battle and they died. That was his job. And now he's got to look and say, what did we do this for? And he joins us now. 32 years of service, much of it in Afghanistan. Dave Fraser, thank you for your service, as I always say to you when we speak. Dave, you saw people you loved and people you respected and people you commanded die in that battle in Afghanistan for freedom. And now the U.S. is pulling out. What does that feel like now as the Taliban are going to resurge?
Well, first of all, I think it's good to be with you, Evan. And, you know, I think the men and women who served in Afghanistan can stand up with pride with what they tried to do to bring peace and security to a country that hasn't had it for very much. So they did their jobs. They did exactly what we expected them to do. And quite frankly, the men and women who wear the uniforms from all the nations bought time for diplomats and other people, including Afghans, to try to find a solution, which unfortunately today it looks like isn't there.
You say the military bought time. You did your job. Was there a failure in Afghanistan? And I told this story, Dave, originally, someone you work with, General Hillier, Rick Hillier, and I interviewed him back when he was the CDS, the chief of the defense staff in Afghanistan. And he said to me, a Taliban commander said to me, you've got the watches, we've got the time. We're going to wait you out. Eventually you're going to leave. And here we are 20 years later, and they were right. They've waited us out. Was that inevitable, that they were just going to wait out the coalition?
Well, it's kind of turned out that way. I think for a while there was some optimism that, you know, the Afghan people themselves would choose a democratically elected government. But, you know, they never haven't taken up that opportunity to try to reconcile with the moderate side of the Taliban and kind of do what they happened in Northern Ireland when you legitimize Sinn Féin and to make them an opposition party. It's never happened in Afghanistan. So I think the Afghan leadership has to take responsibility for the fact that they missed this opportunity to try to bring some peace and stability to their own country. I mean, the military did what it needed to do. And, you know, including the Afghan military, were doing the same thing. But the Afghan leadership have got to accept the responsibility that we are not going to be there forever. And Biden made the decision, but he's one of three presidents we're trying to get out of there after 20 years now. It's time for the Afghans to take ownership of this.
But if you see, what do you expect to happen now? And I'm speaking of retired Major General Dave Fraser, who led our troops and international troops in battle in Operation Medusa in Afghanistan. And I've read, you know, Dave, you and I have spoken about it. It haunts you when you, people lose your lives in battle, but there's a purpose for it. What's going to happen now in Afghanistan in your mind?
Well, I think, so the military reportedly note, I mean, the Biden administration said that you're still committed to the diplomatic effort, but you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the Taliban are just waiting for all the uniforms to leave. And then the last year, there hasn't been any combat in the uniforms with international troops, per se. But the Taliban are going to wait and then take over the countryside that they can do that where there is no Afghan government regime, and then eventually they'll take on the Afghan government and probably have a civil war and overthrow them.
A civil war. I mean, this to me is it must be gut-wrenching for you, the same land and territory that you secured and the institutions, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, the lives lost, and the Taliban's going to come back and take it. There's going to be another war there. Can you, like, it's gut-wrenching for me to hear it. I imagine for you it must be disillusioning.
It is disillusioning that, you know, it wasn't from the lack of effort in the international community, but the Afghans have now got a decision. This is a bit of a forcing function. Do they want to keep and maintain peace and security in their country and defeat the Taliban or bring them on board as an opposition party? Because it's theirs now. It's all theirs now. And for us who spent, Canada spent, a decade plus over there, and, the United States has spent 20 years over there, for all of us is we gave it our best shot. But if you guys don't want peace, it's gut-wrenching for the 150 Canadians who were killed over there, service members, and 162 Canadians in total. For those families, yeah. Why did we go if this is the end?
Why did we go if this is the end? I think the one thing we should not let go unsaid, Dave, and I know I got a minute, is the role of Pakistan. I'm sorry, but Pakistan plays a role here. And what they've done with the Taliban, they have not been allies on this. I know they'll deny that, but I don't know what your view is. But I think that's a huge, huge elephant in the room here.
It is a huge elephant. And Pakistan had a role to play in this. They tacitly supported the Taliban. They've got to take some ownership on this. They could have done an awful lot more because the Taliban came across that border, even though it didn't exist in the Afghans' mind, but, they provided sanctuary for them. And, so part of the responsibility is theirs to hold.
I'm going to just say this, Dave, and this is retired Major General Dave Fraser, who read his book on Operation Medusa. Canadians fought with everything they got, like Canadians always fight, so did many, many men and women. I'll just say this. Hold your head up. As you said, you did your job, and that's what you can do. The rest you can't predict. But the battles you were in, you won. Whether the biggest, the war in the end was won, 20 years is more than you can ever imagine. And Dave Fraser, I thank you and the men and women who serve with you for your service and your dedication. I know there's a hard day, and at 2:15 today, President Biden is going to announce U.S. will withdraw from Afghanistan. And it will be a day, sadly, that the Taliban will declare as a victory day. And we should be thanking Dave Fraser and the men and women who fought for us. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It's Dave Fraser. Makes me sick that this happened to those good men and women. All right, I got to take a break. Overhyped and underplayed. Oh, we're going to lighten it up a bit. I've got something to say to Scott Reed.
Finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show. Favorite time of the week when I invite my old pal Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator, former comms director for Paul Martin, on for Overhyped and Underplayed.
Overhyped.
Create jobs and opportunity.
In this election, here's what I want to do. Or Underplayed.
Overhyped or under. What's overhyped and what's underplayed out there? And Scott and I always we fight about this. This is a really good to have you on the program. I talked to my wife last night and said, I'm going to miss the pandemic when it's all over. Just the quietness of the night. She almost suffocated me with the pillow. She said I was so stupid to even say that. She misses going out so much. She couldn't even believe how I could even see the light on this. Did you ever say something so dumb to your wife? It's just like, don't ever talk like that again.
No. No, I can't recall anything of that sort. And by the way, I've had nothing but success with wives. I don't know. You'll have to take this up with somebody else. I'm perfect.
You are perfect, yeah. How many wives?
Yeah. Well, I guess I, you know, man, you're really, you know, you're reaching into the closet here for me. I would say two.
That's okay. It's good. It's good.
1.81, you know, like I think, you know, there's like common law jurisprudence, right? Like,
that's,
I don't
that's
know.
Right, like, that's right. That's good. No, you're, listen, at everything we do, you're twice as good as me.
Well, there you have it. This may not be the way. This is more like golf. I think low score wins.
that may be true. Okay. Now I'm going to tell folks here, I'm talking to Scott Reed. Scott and I had a back and forth about this movie. We'll take this up last. I think it's called the Justice League. The director, they recut it. It's called the Snyder Cut. It's 4 hours. And Scott had insisted that I watch it. My daughter and I have spent a month. Well, let's just do it right now. A month trying to watch this. And finally this week, after five attempts, we watched this four-hour bloviated thing called the Snyder Cut. I guess Snyder's the name of the director. And this is his recut. He's added like 2 hours to this thing. Superman, Batman, Aquaman, Wonder Woman. I hated this in a way that I haven't hated. And I wrote Scott a review and I said, I have not hated a cut this much since my own circumcision. And yet you liked it. I don't get this.
First of all, your review was longer than the movie. It was longer than the book of Deuteronomy. It was astonishing. And so, you know, I think you have to start with the theatrical release by Joss Whedon, which was a short mess of a film, and this was a long mess of a film.
Right.
My God, the last hour was great fun, and there was lots of, you know, Flash doing stuff, and Batman, and purpose, and they defeated, for now, the grand threat that was Steppenwolf. Look, I think your...
Steppenwolf, first of all, Steppenwolf...
Overhyped in the extreme. Uppercase overhype here. Objective.
You have to underplay how bad this movie is, folks. I really warn you not to watch this piece of crap. Here's why. First of all, it's a derivative of every Marvel movie. Second of all, I guess Snyder recut everything in slow-mo. They walk slowly. They gaze longingly. The whole thing could have been cut to 2 hours if he just took out the ponderous walks, the horrible music. Then at the end, my daughter, who's watching this with me, and she's hating it, and she loves this kind of movie too. She's like obsessed with this kind of movie. There's a dream sequence that they just don't, like, it is so pointless. She's like, Dad, a dream sequence? How did they get Snyder to do this? And yet it's done really well. I have to say, this is overplayed. This is underplayed how bad this is. And every bad thing in movies, time travel, slow-mo, and dream sequences were used. I really am worried that you would like something like this. This is a pandemic movie. You could only love this during a pandemic.
Well, it's not a dream sequence. It's a peek inside an alternate future that is bound to come true unless Batman can save the life of Lois Lane. It all revolves around Lois. And the fact that I have to explain that to you. You know, the difference between you and me is I'm a bit of an intellectual. I enjoy thoughtful character development. You just want, you know, exploding arrows and giant green hulks.
Yes.
I you know, I guess, sorry, you know, can I'm you a just, cerebral just comic book fan.
Just one one time before we move on here. I just want you to repeat that sentence because this is I just want to know that Scott's probably in a basement now with a Dungeons and Dragons set in some full cosplay costume. But are you? What was that sentence you just said to me on air? It's not a dream sequence. It's an alternative.
Not a dream
future.
Sequence. It's a peek inside an alternate future that is contingent upon the survival of Lois Lane. And if you don't understand that, well, I can't explain nothing to you, buddy.
Folks, that is the longest definition of virginity I've ever heard in my entire life. Oh, my God. That was great. All right. Okay. So that is it. I did it. I wish I could time travel and get the time back. But my version is don't watch Justice League, the Snyder Cut. Avoid it even during a pandemic. Scott says watch it.
There you go.
Can I ask you, let's get serious for a second. Are we overhyping or underplaying the vaccine booking confusion and the vaccine rollout situation?
I think as much as it's dominating the headlines and the focus, I think we're still underplaying it. I think that we are we're being almost too accepting of what's an unacceptable botchery. And I don't demand perfection from government. I've worked in government. I know how hard systems are to organize. But I got to tell you, when the premier says 1 week ago today that 18 to 49 in hotspots can get vaccinated, and 1 week later that remains patently not the case. And when you can go into the system, punch in your name, punch in your date of birth, therefore transparently acknowledging that you are not over 49, get an appointment, get a confirmation code, get a PDF that tells you where to freaking park, and show up and still be turned away. Like, to me, this is ridiculous. And you know, Ford talks about the fact that, look, it's not a confusing system. And he's right. It's not that it's confusing. It's that it's not as advertised. So if you're going to make a promise in public and take the political applause for that, put in place the apparatus to fulfill that promise. Otherwise, it's a string tied to squat nothing.
I agree. This is a nightmare. Confusion is the last thing you want. The whole thing was for the 2 months of January and February when the federal government really was screwing up, when we really didn't have enough vaccines, when it really was a shortage, when we really were behind. Don't worry, we're using this time to get the system sorted out. And they didn't get it sorted out. And here we are.
What was Hillier doing? What was like? What, like, if this is the result of months and months of labor, what in hell was he up to?
I really, honestly, the vaccine rollout and trying to book an appointment is like as confusing as the Snyder Cut. This is the Snyder Cut of rollouts in my alternative universes, potential glimpses of another future where things worked out. It's the Snyder Cut of rollouts. It really is. Overhyped or underplayed, the blood clot concerns over AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. Where are you on that?
I'm very much in the overhyped category. You know, I mean, I don't ever want to be glib about a perceivable medical risk. But when you're talking about six cases that are 700,000 doses applied, when you're talking about you know, a warning label issue, when you think about what women who have been taking the pill forever and had to deal with blood clotting put up with, you know, to me, I'm very, very, like, it's not the fault of the media. It drives me crazy when I say people, why are the media reporting this? Media must report it. But then we should have public health officials and government officials weighing in to place perspective in and around this issue. We tolerate threats far graver than this all the time, and I think it's way overhyped.
I totally agree with you. As Dr. Bogosh and Health Canada has said, the benefits of the vaccine far outweigh the risk. I'm totally with you. All right, that is Scott Reed, overhyped and underplayed. Send me a note of the next movie. I'll still take your advice. Whatever movie you think I should watch, I will try. It took me a month to get through the last one, but just try to...
Hey, no, if, just before you go, I want you to...
I have 10 seconds.
Important piece of trivia. What? Yeah. Who's this?
I don't know.
That's Jared Leto Joker from the alternative future.
Oh, my God. I got to take a break. My head blew off.
As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
All right, welcome back to the program as we come to an ending. I'm getting a lot of texts about my conversation with Scott Reed and the Snyder Cut, which is that Justice League movie out now on Crave. You could see the recut of that DC comic. My parents, who are probably listening, are like, what is he talking about? It's like a superhero movie, Mom and Dad, with Superman and Batman and Aquaman and Wonder Woman, and they're taking on Lex Luthor and some space alien, and it's a derivative knockoff of Marvel, but lots of people like it, and the people that love these DC comic movies love them so much, and if you don't like it, you know, this would be like being dropped in a box in the lake in the freezing cold in the dark for 4 hours. It's just so bad. And Scott loved it, and he insisted I watch it, and then, you know, it was like a 4 hour experience that my daughter and I tried to watch, and it took us a month. We kept trying it, and it was so awful. Anyway, we finished it last night, and I told Scott we should talk about it. And I said it, the Snyder Cut, that's what it's called, because the director recut it. And I said, I haven't hated a cut this much since my own circumcision. And some people are saying that's exactly my experience. And some are texting me at 7:10:10 saying, Evan, you have no taste. It's a movie. But anyway, I promised you at the end of this show, you can text me on that. Maybe you like this Snyder Cut. I just think you're locked in your house for, you know, a year. You'll like anything because there's nothing to do. But anyway, I got so many texts at the beginning of our show when I was telling you the story that last night I was, you know, went to bed lying beside my wife and
my wife.
Just reading my wife. And I said to her, hey, Tam, you know, part of this I'm going to just miss, you know, watching movies with the kids and not having to go anywhere. The kind of the slowness and, you know, my commute to work is like going to the basement. You just go to the office and the kids are home. And there's something I like about how slow everything has become. And she was like, are you out of your mind? 23,000 people have died. I haven't been to a restaurant in a year. I miss my family. I miss my friends. There is nothing good about this. Do not become Stockholm Syndrome and fall for the kidnapper of COVID. And then I realized, yeah, she's right. There's nothing good. I mean, I'm a very optimistic person. But 1-855-633-1010. The text started pouring in and the calls did at the beginning. Or at 7-10-10. 1-855-633-1010. Or 7-10-10. Do you kind of secretly, in a shameful way, kind of like the silver lining of this? That it's kind of slow out there. And the hustle and bustle is, you know, no traffic. And are you kind of liking it? In a little way, even though I know we all want it to end, let me know. Call me at because I want to know. Or is it just the stupidest thing you've ever heard? Which is my wife's position on this. And Hannah, my producer, who's in her 20s, who lives in an apartment with no balcony. I say this, and it's like saying, "Hey, you know that time when that guy was fishing and he cast his rod and the fish hook got caught in your cheek?" That's what this is like. And you're saying, yeah, that kind of felt good because it was kind of like, it was almost like flossing. No, it wasn't. It was a hook in my face. That's what this feels like for her. So I should never, there's no silver lining there. 1-855-633-1010 or 7-10-10. But I kind of think there is. Just a little. Hi, Evan. I totally agree with you. Oh, this is good. Thank you for this text. I'm going to pick this one selectively. I've had this conversation with my husband. As much as I've enjoyed the less hectic life this last year, my husband is missing our busy social life. He, too, just looks at me like I have three heads. Thanks for saying out loud. So glad I'm not the only one who feels it, says Lenore McKean. Lenore! I mean, I kind of am with your husband, and I think we all are, but there's something here, you know? We were so busy for so long. Evan, you can obviously have been making your full wages through this. I have not. I do not share your like if the current situation. I'd say much more, but it wouldn't be nice, as Stephanie. Stephanie, you're right. This is why I'm embarrassed to say it, because so many people have suffered. Like you, Stephanie. I agree. And that's why I feel so ashamed to say there's something. You're right. The privileged position I have, you're 100% right. Your comment is exactly what my wife was saying. So, Stephanie, I hear you. I agree. Evan, I love not having to be somewhere every night. My schedule was packed. I hated running around from place to place. I'm going to slow down a bit post-pandemic as a result. I just want to say to Steph and Stephanie, like, you're right. Most people have suffered here. So it's not like I love this, but I'm just telling you something that is I'm feeling. Anne, what's up?
There's more. I totally understand the suffering and the loss of jobs and everything else, and that's awful. I have three sons. They're all in their early to mid-20s. They've been home every day. One was away at school. He came home. One works at the bank. He's working at home. The other one does go to work every day, but they would be out with their friends. They would be gone. They'd be at school. I have enjoyed every second of having my three sons at home with me this last year.
I agree with you. I love having the kids here, but I could tell you if I was in my kids' age, and thanks for the call, I would have gone crazy. Like I wanted to get, I love my parents, but I left home at 16. I fled for 3 months to the Arctic. Then I went to school. Like I had happy feet to get out, and I know my kids probably feel the same way, and they should. So they're totally self-centered. I totally agree. Kids should get out, and I feel for the kids. This is a nightmare for them. I feel for those who aren't working. Someone just said to me, like, I'm getting a lot of people who agree with me. I agree how peaceful it is. It's great. But there's some text that I love this. Anyone who likes this is an antisocial loser. I agree with your wife, Evan. She's right. There's nothing good about this. Not one darn thing. Yeah, I try to see the good things. But you're not wrong. It sucks for so many people. But this is so funny how many people are secretly kind of, again, no one likes people getting sick. No one likes not seeing their family, not seeing their friends. And no one wants someone like Stephanie to be out of a job. It sucks. There's no good. I'm not trying to spin that for some kind of blind privilege thing. But I will say this. I'm getting a lot of this. Evan, I'm enjoying the quiet time. We like the slowness. Like, our lives had been hyper-accelerated. This one, though, I've been married 46 years, Evan. If I don't take my wife out for a romantic supper soon, I will not be married for 47 years. That's true. I just, someone just said, you're not alone. I like the quiet. I like that we've learned to appreciate time with loved ones. It's like we've gone back to a simpler time. I'm just going to say this. It is true, but the cost of that is too high. You know, for this little realization that it's nice to be together, the costs are way too high. The cost to lives, the cost to jobs, the cost to our freedom. I'm not condoning this. I hate it. I can't wait to go out again. I get it. But I got to say, there are some moments after a long day, and I get to go to work. Like, after this call, I'm going to get up and go to work. So the walls aren't closing in on me like on my wife and on my kids and on you. And I've got work, unlike people like Stephanie. But man, there is something here that I really genuinely do like. And I got to admit it. I will never say it again to my wife, because there's no way I can get away with this twice. So you will never hear me say this again. I will go along with the choir and just say it sucks. Thanks for listening, everyone. Great show. Love hearing your comments. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and I'll see you tonight on Power Play at 5 p.m.